This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Along with your calls, some interesting research to talk about, Zorba?
Yes, learning to talk when you're an infant. You know, when does language really start? Interesting information that looks at MRI scanning of babies' brains when they're nonverbal. Fascinating data.
As to whether they can understand?
Whether they can understand and what they understand and what's going on in their brains. And the safety of dental fillings. It's mercury again. Mercury in those dental fillings again. We'll talk about that. It's recently been in the news.
I know what you're going to be talking about.
It's been in the news.
And a good recipe?
Hearty lamb and veggie stew. It's a wonderful recipe. Lamb, which is often considered a fat meat, is not fat when used in this stew recipe. It's great.
Okay. I love stew and I like lamb coming up. Here's your number. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
How can we help?
We just moved into a new house that we built and found that we had hard water. And so we put in a water softener. And it's standard water softener. And I'm a PhD-level meteorologist, and so I'm pretty good with numbers, and I figured out roughly how much sodium was being put into the water. But there's also potassium chloride available to put in water softeners. And so I was curious about whether there might be any health benefit to using potassium chloride instead of sodium chloride.
Well, you bring up an excellent point. I've got a question for you.
Are you a TV weather guy?
No. I'm a PhD-level research meteorologist. You know, I'm a doctor, but I'm not the kind that helps anybody.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Would you help you?
Oh, maybe that wasn't Zorba's question, but that was my question.
That's a great question. In our house, we have a water softener, and in many, many houses where we are in Wisconsin, the water that comes out of the kitchen sink is not softened water. You should not be drinking. I mean, the reality is, have you looked at the plumbing in your house to see if soft water comes out of your tap and your sink?
Yeah, when we built the house, we didn't expect to have this problem, and everything is under a slab, so it's not something we can add.
Oh, well, the water is under the slab that comes into the house?
Yes, yeah, because we're on a well, of course.
Oh, because you're, I'm going to be on the well, too, so I understand the well things. Well, the answer is you may want to look at that because you're having a lot of sodium. And the reality is you can also get too much potassium that comes through the water. The problem is, of course, you didn't understand that. When you built the house, your goal is really to drink water which has not been softened with sodium or potassium. And you may want to look at developing another line that goes into your house because you're going to be living there for a long time that basically goes from the well, a different line that you dig, and gives water in the sink that is not softened water. Because in our house, for instance, we have in the sink downstairs in our kitchen, the water is not softened, and then in all the other sinks in the house, the water is softened. And that's really how you sort of get around it. So you might use potassium, but then you can run into the problem. We don't need too much potassium, and the issue is you may get too much. You can get hyperkalemia, which is too much potassium, and that can be bad as hypernatremia, which is too much sodium. So I don't think you're going to get much out of it. But the reality is you do have a problem because you should not be getting that much sodium. It's a lot of – you did the calculation. It's a lot of sodium you get in softened
water. Well, it's about 160 milligrams per liter.
So, that's my advice. Dig another well. It's a little expensive.
Is there any health danger going on?
Well, you can figure out if you do the calculation. I don't think there is a health danger because if you do the calculations, although you're getting some significant sodium, you're still not getting as much as we get when we eat on a regular basis. They're dead. I don't think I would go to potassium because I think I would worry about we don't need nearly as much potassium as we need sodium. We need little bits and pieces of potassium by comparison to sodium. So I don't think I would switch over to potassium. You might also notice a difference in taste. Potassium has a bitter taste. And if you take people who use light salt or potassium salt on their food because they have to, they don't like the taste of it. It does not taste the same. And if you want to see what it tastes like, go to the store and buy some potassium salt. It's called light salt, half potassium, half sodium, and try it on your food and see if you like it. And the chances are you'll go back to the water softener with sodium.
It's interesting you mention that because I've been using that for years.
Light salt.
Tastes fine to me.
Well, you know, there's really no accounting for taste when it comes to people. So you like the taste of softened of light salt?
Yeah, it actually doesn't taste different to me.
Why do you use light salt on your food? Because you're a meteorologist? Is that the reason? And you just know that
because he's got all that salt in his water.
I guess because I have all the salt in that water.
No, he just moved into the house. He's been saying, why do you use light salt on your food? I'm serious.
I like a little bit of salt on my food and had read that, well, you know, we all get too much salt in all the stuff
it's this scientific bent. You're reading too much. You're just too intelligent.
You PhDs.
You PhDs.
You got too much to worry
you
about.
You got too much to think about and worry about.
Hang up the phone and enjoy your water.
A little bit of education goes too far.
Yeah. And thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You know, that is the first person I have ever met who uses light salt electively. That is the first person who uses that.
1-800. You can't be too careful. 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener with us now in Logan, Utah. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
I have high blood pressure, and I've had it since I was 22. It's kind of just increased steadily a little bit since then. But about a year ago, I moved to Logan, Utah, and I've always lived at sea level. Mm-hmm. And when I moved here about a week or 2 weeks later, I noticed a huge spike in my blood pressure, and it really hasn't gone down. Mm. And so I was just wondering if elevation would cause a spike in elevation.
Interesting question, Zorba.
It's fascinating. Blood pressure does change with elevation. And like you said, you're at Logan. So what are you at, about 5,000 feet, 6,000 feet?
Yeah,
at Logan, something like that. So you became hypertensive. You developed high blood pressure in your 20s. Was it related to anything? Birth control pills, for instance, can cause high blood pressure. Was it related to that? Were you on the pill?
Yes. But we noticed on the first time I came just to get checked before I started that it was higher than it had been ever before.
So your blood pressure was higher even before you were placed on the pill. So what's your pressure running? What is it running right now?
Currently it runs on an average day 180 to over 120.
Oh, your blood pressure is 180 over 120?
Well, that's high.
That is really high. Have you seen a doctor since you've been there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And?
We've tried lots of different pills, and they don't seem to drop it.
Well, you ought to be able to bring that pressure down. How many medicines are you on right now?
I'm on something called Benicar, and then a diuretic.
But you're on two blood pressure. I mean, you may need to be on three or four blood pressure pills.
Three or four.
You bet. That is the reality, and some people have. But you also need a complete workup to find out if something else is going on. How old are you?
I'm 28.
Yeah, you've got to see either a family doc or an internist, somebody who's used to treating high blood pressure. Because you may need two pills, you may need three pills, you might need four. I do know one thing. You need to get your blood pressure down closer to 120 over 80. And when your blood pressure is 180 over 110, that is dangerous. And so you need to get it down, and you need to see somebody right away to do that. So good luck to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling us.
You know, it's incredibly important. What we know is that the closer to 120 over 80, the better off you are. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who is in their 20s to have their blood pressure over 180 over 110 or 120 is a very dangerous thing. It's really an emergency type situation, and it's really important for her to go get some help.
800-462-7413. Toll free, of course. 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, some brain scanning of little tiny babies and research on what they understand
very
and what
interesting
they don't.
Research. And this is research looking at language in infancy. We know that language develops in infancy. The question is when, and you know, children begin to speak at about roughly, you know, a year of age, three quarters of a year to a year, but do they really understand earlier? Now, This is interesting in one way, but it also really corroborates information that I saw and learned about many, many years ago in somebody who had sign language. And this was somebody who learned sign language and was not deaf and taught their children sign language and said basically they believe that their children learned about 50 to 100 signs before they were able to speak. And that this data has since been corroborated in other studies. But this looked at MR scanning of the brain, looked at areas in the brain. There's an area called Broca's area, and Broca's area in the brain is the area that is responsible for language. And they would have a parent read a story to their child and to three-month-old infants.
3 months.
And they looked at the area, the frontal area of the brain, the frontal cortex and the temporal lobe, and they looked at Broca's area. And lo and behold, they found out that these areas lit up. That children were processing the words. When you put the children in front of just noise or in front of sound that wasn't language, those areas did not light up. So clearly they were paying attention to those sounds and developing language. There are a lot of issues of where does language develop. Not only that, but it appeared based on what we understand about forming sentences that children were actually trying to string together these sounds together to form a sentence that made some sense to them. And it was very, very interesting. So these little baby brains are little baby sponges, and obviously from birth and probably in the womb, they're beginning to develop these language skills.
We have a friend who's signing to the little baby under that same assumption. So the message here is read to your kids?
The message here is read to your kids, absolutely. The message is read to your kids when they're infants because it develops language. And this goes along with other studies that show that people who have gone to college are much more likely to use a variety of language skills and sort of with their children than people who have not gone to college. People will say who are high school graduates or high school dropouts. And when you look at the number of words called utterances, in other words, how often, you know, the number of sort of syllables you give per minute and per hour, it tends to be about 50 to 75% more if you've gone to college. So one theory is that children, when they learn all of these sounds early on, they're much more likely to learn language, they're more likely to read, they're more likely to go to college, and they're more likely to graduate from college, which in our society means they're more likely to make more money.
Yeah, right.
So these are really very important things to do.
And that's the only reason you want to go to college.
Only for money, that's all. Only for money.
If they're so smart at 3 months, how come when they're two and you say, stop doing that?
That's right. They don't have the language skills. That's right. Or when they're 12 and you say, stop doing it, they don't do it either.
Or when they're 18.
That's right. Say, stop doing it. That his language skill is off. That's right. There you go, Tom.
800-462-7413. Question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. To a listener now in Ashland, Oregon. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
How can we help you?
I hope you can. I woke up a few days ago with a pain in the soft tissue along the edge of my jawbone under my chin on the left side only. And originally there was no pain in my neck, lymph gland, or anywhere else. It's moved slightly down into my neck now. And I was wondering if you might be able to offer me any possible steps to address whatever this might be.
Yeah, take two aspirin and call me in the morning.
No.
That was always the joke my mother-in-law would say. Well, pain in the jaw can be from a variety of things. And without a physical examination, it's often very tough, you know, very tough to tell. It can be from lymph glands that happen because you might have an infection either in your face, in your throat, or in your jaw. It can be from the way you are lying in bed. Sometimes that'll produce it. It can be certainly from a sore throat or a strep throat. What other symptoms do you have besides this kind of jaw discomfort?
Well, it's like in the tissue under the bone.
Mm-hmm. So it's under the bone underneath the jaw. Well, we do have lymph glands that are underneath the jaw. Couldn't be from that. But frankly, these are one of the things that very clearly you need to get an examination on if it stays there. Now, if it goes away in a few days, I don't think I'd be concerned. It's been there for how many days at this point?
About 3 days.
So I don't think I would be concerned until it's about a week or 10 days, in all seriousness. Most of these things are infectious. You know, usually a little jaw pain will go away and it's not worrisome. But I have to tell you, things that such as pain in the jaw or swelling can be worrisome. One of the symptoms of Hodgkin's disease, which is cancer of the lymph glands, can be pain or swelling in the jaw, lymph nodes in the arm, lymph nodes under the armpit, and so on. And so it's really the pains that last for a week or 10 days, or the swelling that keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger that doesn't go away. Those are the things that we sort of worry about. And that's a very, very small, tiny percentage of things such as this. Most of these go away. They're usually infectious in origin, and they get better. Warm, moist compresses can do that. Tylenol can do it. And, of course, aspirin will help get rid of that pain, too.
And don't forget to call me in the morning.
Yeah, right. Right.
But after a week, 10 days, go to the doc? Is that the deal?
Yeah, I think so. I think if it's not any better and it's still there, you really should go, because there are many things that this can be. Once again, you know, dental things can cause pain in the jaw. Sinuses can cause pain in the jaw. A bunch of things can cause pain in the face. Difficult to say, but give it some time. It might go away on its own.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. On we go to Nampa, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine. And how can we help you?
Well, I have a big trip coming up in a couple months.
Oh, where are you going?
Micronesia.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Now, have you heard of it?
Yeah,
yes.
But how did you decide on Micronesia?
My husband is from Micronesia, and we have a daughter together, so we're going back to so I can meet his family.
Oh.
So I'm worried about getting sick because they're, you know, they don't have a lot of the modern conveniences, and they don't have indoor plumbing or electricity on the island that we're going to.
Mm-hmm.
They eat a lot of raw fish, and I guess I was just wondering what I could do to prepare myself so that I don't get sick.
So which island are you going to?
It's called Atoll.
Atoll.
Okay, now is that near the state of Chuuk.
Okay. That's what I thought. I mean, I've heard of Chuuk. I never knew how to pronounce it, if it was Chuuk or Truk, but
It used to be Truk. Now it's Chuuk.
Maybe that's why I've always been confused whether it was Truk or Chuuk. So yeah. It used to be Truk, mm-hmm. and now it's Chuuk. Well, first of all, good recommendation. You go to cdc.gov. That's the Centers for Disease Control.gov, G-O-V.
Okay.
Look at the website. Go off to the left-hand side. There's a map of the world. Go to Micronesia. Hit Micronesia, and it'll tell you all the things you should do. Great, great website. Gives lots of good information. Talks about immunizations. Let's talk about water. You're right. The water is not necessarily filtered. The water may not be good. What you want to do, and when you're there, you may, by the way, be able to buy bottled water. You never trust that. You want to make sure you can basically take care of the water and make filtered water yourself. And you can do that either by bringing a filter and filtering it, or by water purification tablets, which are basically bleach. You can either use the iodine ones, or you can get bleach ones, and that's what I would do. And I would bring canteens, and I would definitely either drink bottled water, filtered water, or bleached water. And one of the reasons is they're used to the local bacteria in the water, and they won't necessarily get sick, but you may get sick.
Right.
And you're not going to be there.
In Mexico.
How long? Yeah, exactly. How long are you going to be there for?
For about 34 days.
34 days. So what I would do is when, for instance, my wife and I traveled through Southeast Asia, we had canteens. We either chlorinated or iodinated the water. And we did that by going to a camping supply store and buying the material, you know, to be able to do that. You can also often heat the water when you're there if you have access to that. I assume even though they don't have indoor plumbing, they have access to propane and they cook, as my understanding of Micronesia. Is that correct?
I think on the island we're going to, it's mainly over a fire.
So you're not going to want to boil water over the fire. So what you're, because you're going to a very, very third world area, you clearly want to do that with water. But the CDC website will tell you about any infectious diseases that may be there. And that's basically the thing to do. You want to bring medicines with you, though, a first aid kit. You want to bring Cipro, which is an antibiotic you get from your doctor in case you develop traveler's diarrhea.
Oh.
So call up your doctor. You want to have Cipro and you want to have Imodium. It's very, very good for traveler's diarrhea. You want to make sure you have an antibiotic with you in case you get a skin infection or something mm-hmm. such as that. That's what I always tell people. You want something for motion sickness, of course, in case you have problems and if there are allergies in case. So how big is Chuuk? It's not a very big island.
Well, Chuuk itself is just a state, but there are probably, I'm just guessing, maybe 100 islands within
But Atoll is, how big is Atoll, the little island you're going to?
The population is maybe 200.
Uh-huh. Where did you, 200 is small. Where did you meet your husband, if I may ask?
Well, his aunt went to college and met her husband, who's from China, and they have a restaurant here together. They hire family to come over and work.
How long since he's been back?
He's gone back almost every year.
Ah.
But this is the first time I'm going
first
back.
First time. Well, why don't you just stay at the True Hilton?
At the True Hilton. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So you must be excited, huh?
I am. I'm really excited.
You should must be really, very excited be to see really all the exciting. Relatives and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, send us some pictures when you get back, please.
I will. Thank you for the great advice.
Thanks, thanks a lot for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Zorba, time for a comment now from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. Looks like you might be caught in a pickle here, Zorba. This one comes to us from Melissa in Joplin, Missouri. Melissa writes, recently, you talked with a caller trying to quit caffeine and smoking and was having headaches. You suggested Excedrin Migraine. While comparing the Excedrin label to a generic equivalent, I noticed that Excedrin Migraine has all of the same ingredients as regular Excedrin, which included 65 milligrams of
caffeine.
Yes.
That's right.
I don't
That's
know right. if this is enough caffeine to keep the headache merry-go-round going, but I wanted you to know that Excedrin Migraine is no different than regular Excedrin, except for the packaging.
Except for the packaging. That's exactly right. Well, there is a difference. The packaging really does make a difference to people.
The placebo.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I have patients that say regular Excedrin doesn't work, but Excedrin Migraine does the trick. Do you think I'm going to tell them no? I say absolutely. If it works and gets rid of your headache, take it. She brings up a very good point. But quite often, when you're going through caffeine withdrawal, you have to have very small amounts of caffeine as you're going through that. And that often is very,
this
very
is small enough.
Yeah,
so that's
a small enough amount.
Yeah.
And it's what you use, and then eventually you stop
but
it.
That
but
is
she brings
funny
up a good
that,
point.
That,
and you know what?
It's the same thing.
I love people who are OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, because they're the ones that give me all this data. But that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
We enjoy your comments, tips, and the occasional correction. Just send them along to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up, and some more interesting research, and a medical myth buster, and a recipe. So much, the recipe is next, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time, and then back to your calls at 800-462-7413. Zorba, I am really looking forward not only to listening to you put these ingredients together for this hearty lamb and veggie stew, but looking forward to actually tasting it.
Oh, I love lamb.
You really do. Lamb. You really work at them. I mean, you
I
really work
lamb.
At them.
That's
you
right,
had them in the kitchen.
That's right, in the kitchen.
Putting the soup
on the
together.
On 24/7.
So here it
thing.
Is right next to me, and I'm going to taste
I love
this.
Lamb, and I developed a taste for lamb when my wife and I lived in Nova Scotia, and it just reminds me of this crazy story many, many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was delivering babies, and I delivered a wonderful woman in she had no insurance. She had no money. And she said, I'll give you lamb. And she raised,
just like the old doc days.
Just like the old doc days. And it was kind of neat. So I thought I would go down and pick out the lamb. So, you know, I took my daughter,
Dee
Dee.
To be slaughtered.
I went took down my daughter, Dee Dee. Right. That's exactly what happened. We looked at the lamb.
How old was Dee Dee at the time?
Oh, she was 5 or 6 or something like that. You know, took and, you know, how do you like these lambs? And, oh, I like this little lamb. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And not much. We went to the farm. And 2 weeks later, this wonderful lamb arrives, and I make a wonderful lamb stew. And we're sitting down at dinner having lamb stew. At the table, said, this is lamb, kids. We're introducing you to lamb. We think you like lamb. And they're eating the stew. And Dee Dee said, oh, this is wonderful. She really liked the taste. And she said, lamb, where did you get the lamb? And I blurted out, remember the farm we went to? And all of a sudden, I came out of my mouth like a parent, and I realized that I had said, we went to the farm, and this is the lamb that you picked out, and we're eating it at the table. And all of a sudden, she burst into tears. And for the next 2 decades of her life, I don't think she had one piece of lamb.
Okay, well, Dee Dee won't enjoy this recipe. But
no,
the rest
she
of
won't.
Us
no,
might.
She's grown up since then.
Oh, all right.
She realized it's not her fault that lamb was being slaughtered.
Okay,
anyway.
All right.
She's in medical school. She understands these things.
So let's do it.
Start out with 1 pound of lamb stew meat. Now, what's very important is this. If you buy lamb stew meat, if you buy it from a butcher, much better to buy it from a butcher. You want to have it lean. Lamb can be very fatty.
Right.
The stew isn't going to be as good. You want to try to have, if you can, lean lamb stew meat.
1 pound of lamb stew meat and cut it up?
That's right. You cut it up. And the butcher will cut it up at the store or at a butcher shop, but you want to have lean meat. 1 tablespoonful of flour.
A big tea flour.
That's right, all-purpose flour.
Right.
2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
Always extra virgin. It's the best tasting.
Okay.
1 large green pepper cut into 1-inch pieces.
A large green pepper cut into 1-inch pieces.
1 medium onion finely chopped.
A medium onion finely chopped.
3 cloves of garlic chopped.
3 cloves of garlic chopped.
That's right. And if you love garlic like I do, you can add 6 or 9 or 12.
I can never have
too much garlic.
Yeah.
2 cups of low salt, low sodium, and low salt chicken broth.
2 cups of low salt chicken broth.
That's right. 1/4 cup of red wine.
1/4 cup. Red wine.
That's right, red wine. 2 tablespoonfuls of red wine vinegar.
2 big tea red wine vinegar.
2 tablespoonfuls of tomato paste.
2 big tea tomato paste.
2 medium carrots.
2 medium carrots.
1 cup of fresh mushrooms.
1 cup of fresh mushrooms.
And salt and pepper.
S&P to taste.
That's right. So place the lamb in a large bowl, season with the salt and pepper, then add the flour, toss it around to coat it. Heat 1 tablespoonful of olive oil in a large pot over medium heat and the lamb and saute it until brown. That's what you're doing. You're sauteing, you're sort of sealing the outside of these lamb chunks. Then transfer the lamb to a separate bowl using a slotted spoon. Heat the remaining 1 tablespoonful of olive oil in the same pot. Scrape the bottom of the pot to get the stuff off the bottom, which is very, very important. It's very delicious. Add the pepper, onion, garlic, and saute until the onion begins to soften. Then return the lamb and juices to the pot. Add the chicken broth, tomato paste, red wine, and red wine vinegar. Bring to a boil, medium to low heat for 1 hour. 1 hour, and then add the carrots and simmer for about another 20 minutes. And then at the end, add the mushrooms and simmer uncovered until the mushrooms are tender. That's about 5 minutes. And bon appetit.
Mm.
You will have an absolutely delicious recipe.
Mm.
You love it, huh?
Is this good or what?
You love it. It is absolutely a delicious recipe. If you like lamb stew, I can't get Tom away from it to even taste this.
Mm.
If you like lamb stew, you're having lots of portions of this.
You know what Adam did?
This
is wonderful, too.
What did he do?
He left out the mushrooms. I'm not a big mushroom fan.
He left out the mushrooms. You're not a big mushroom fan?
No.
Oh, I love mushrooms. You love the taste of this, though.
Mm.
Maybe I'll make this tonight. It sounds absolutely delicious. Mm. What's nice is it's 223 calories per serving. Not much fat, 10 grams of fat, which is still a bit on the low side.
Adam didn't trim the fat very well.
Come on, Tom. Give the guy a break. Stop eating it. This is not your lunchtime. So if you want a copy of the recipe, come to our website at www.zorbapastor.org, and it'll be on our website.
Send us a business-size stamped self-addressed envelope. Send it to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue,
dynamite.
Madison, Wisconsin, our zip 53706. Be sure to enclose that self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We'll be happy to send the recipe along to you. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. You have a question for Zorba? Give us a call at 800-462-7413. A listener joins in now, Zorba, from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. My question was about ground turkey.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed in lately that I've been gaining a little bit of weight, and I hate diets. I want to change the way I eat just a little bit, but, you know, not change completely.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between ground turkey and lean ground beef, I really don't know. If you go to the grocery store, you see ground turkey, and you see 99% fat-free, and you see 97% fat-free, and then you see 85% fat-free.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that if you get the ratio of 99 or 97, cooking with it, it seems to get maybe a little bit mealy. And if you use the 85% fat-free, then it has the same consistency as hamburger. And you can fry it like a hamburger on the grill, or you can make a meatloaf or meatballs or spaghetti or whatever. And it has the same consistency and almost taste, you know, if you spice it right, as mm-hmm. hamburger. But I didn't know if I was kind of not doing any good by using that.
Yeah, Zorba?
If you look at ground turkey, one of the issues is whether it's ground white meat or dark meat, because ground turkey on the whole tends to be dark meat. And the reason is dark meat is not as premium a meat when they sell it as white meat. People buy more white meat than dark meat, and they're willing to pay more money for their white meat than they pay for the dark meat that they have. So one of the issues when you have ground turkey is the fact that when you have an 85%, it's going to be mostly dark meat. It's not going to be white meat, and you're pretty much at the same fat content as beef, and so there may not be much of an advantage at all to go to 85%, you know, 85% fat-free
right.
versus 95 or 98% fat-free in terms of what you're trying to do. What you're trying to do is cut down on fat. You're trying to cut down on saturated fat, and the way that you basically cut down on these things is by essentially doing this. So that's the issue, and that's the problem. So the challenge that you have is trying to make sure that you go back to that 95 or 98%. And one of the things that you can do then in the turkey itself, if you are frying it and sautéing it in the pan, is to use a Teflon pan, spray it with Pam, and maybe put some olive oil in it when you're making your turkey burger, because that's really the issue. If you're doing it on the grill, what you want to do is add moisture to it so that there's more moisture in terms of seasonings. And the way you add moisture is you may put in things such as onions. You can actually put other flavor extenders such as soybean. Hamburger Helper is a perfect example. It's made of soybean. That's what it is, and it extends the hamburger. It will work the same with turkey and basically give it more moisture, which is what you're looking for, and it's a vegetable protein, which is really pretty good. So Hamburger Helper would be an excellent, you know, as a name brand, an excellent way to sort of extend that without giving it the fat. You really don't want to go to the 85% fat, because you might as well eat burgers then.
Just negating the purpose. Okay.
There's no reason behind that. So you want to increase the moisture with the soy protein, such as, you know, a soy protein extender, and then you worry about the oil. You want the oil to be on the surface so that the burger, the turkey burger, does not spit. And what they're using in the more fat-free turkey, which is more expensive, is they're using more white meat. That's basically what that is, or they're just not putting in the fat.
Excellent.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I've got a puzzle that maybe you can help me solve.
Oh, Zorba will solve the puzzle for you.
Since I was 20, 21, I've enjoyed, a glass of wine most evenings with my meal,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes a glass at 4 or 4:30 after work, and then maybe another glass during dinner. So I'm not talking about huge consumption. I've considered wine, red wine and white wine, mostly dry, like Chardonnay or Syrah,
mm-hmm.
Delightful experience until the last 6 months or so. By now, I'm 62 years old, and so I have a long history of the delights of wine,
mm-hmm.
and now it's turned into every time I take a sip of wine, well, the first or second sip, it becomes an episode of gagging and feeling like my throat was going to close up.
Hmm.
It doesn't. And then it sort of goes into a warm kind of almost nauseous feeling, and then I start hiccuping. And this is every single time.
So this is every time that you do this.
Yeah. It doesn't happen with beer or with orange juice or other acidic kinds of
drinks. Do you have it on an empty stomach?
I usually have a little something first, like maybe one Triscuit. I'm watching my weight, and I...
Well, one of the things to find out is whether or not this is related to the empty stomach syndrome of having it on a relatively empty stomach. And what I would recommend is halfway through the meal, have the wine and see if the same thing happens.
It does. It does
happen. So it always. So even if it's halfway through the
meal.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
I must tell you, I've never heard of anything like this.
You
definitely stumped me. If it's a sulfite allergy, it ought to occur as long as you continue drinking the wine.
It's
not that. And if it's an alcohol issue, it ought to occur with other forms of alcohol.
Are you still drinking the wine and going through that awful process?
I mean, I hold out for the fourth and fifth sip.
You hold out.
Is it worth it to go through that gagging and hiccuping?
You know, sometimes it is not. Sometimes I just don't want to put myself through
it. I'd substitute a shot and a beer for that.
Shot and a beer. There we go. Shot and a beer. Thank you, Tom. Shot and a beer is where it's at.
Well, now this is disappointing. I wanted you to give me a magic trick.
You tricked me. You stumped me. Thanks.
Sorry.
Do you think it has anything to do with acid reflux?
Well, it should, but other things ought to disturb acid reflux, too. I mean, it could definitely be acid reflux, but it should occur with having other forms of alcohol, such as beer and a shot. So, so good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Sorry we couldn't help.
Sorry.
Time for a quick tip, Zorba. Not long ago, we were talking about jellyfish stings and the myth that urine worked as a remedy.
That is correct.
Right. Well, we proved that it doesn't work, and I don't want to think about that theory and how we found that out. But anyway, we had a bunch of our listeners let us in on a remedy that they think will work. They all suggested, this is for a jellyfish thing, meat tenderizer.
That's one of the other cures of meat tenderizer.
So the listeners that say that are right.
Yeah, well, it is, but still does not work as well as vinegar. Vinegar tends to be the quickest thing to sort of neutralize it. But that is the other thing, meat tenderizer.
So our listeners are right, but they're not as right as you are.
There we go. There we go. Meat tenderizer is that. But if you go to beaches in Australia, they have vinegar all over the beaches, and they don't have bottles of meat tenderizer.
How do people discover these things?
Well, how'd they discover the urine? Where'd the urine come from?
Get some meat tenderizer.
Meat tenderizer. Yeah. Don't urinate on me. Get some meat tenderizer.
Anyway, enough of that. How many jellyfish things do people
also,
get?
How many people getting jellyfish stings?
I know. That. But if you want to let us know your tips about something else, send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, you're not going to want to go away because we have some really interesting research coming up. We have a medical myth buster and more of your calls right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Want to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Research time, Zorba, and this may be troubling to some. A federal advisory panel rejecting the FDA's conclusion that mercury in dental fillings poses little or no health risk to patients?
Right. Well, the controversy continues, and the controversy has been going on for a long time. First of all, we have to look at mercury. We know that mercury is not good for children as they're growing up in the growing brain. We know that. And a number of years ago, we started trying to reduce mercury in the environment. We worry about eating too much fish in areas where there's mercury. We try to get rid of mercury in the waters and so on. But there is mercury in dental fillings, in these amalgams, which is what they're called. and they contain mercury, plus they contain other metals.
But now we thought that was solved. The FDA had said not long, you know, years ago or whatever, that mercury fillings are okay. But now here comes this advisory panel.
And the EPA in 1993 and the U.S. Public Health Service in 1997, they all say it's okay. And here you have a panel, advisory panel from the FDA, where the federal advisory panel says, no, we don't know if it's safe. You really can't say it's safe. We can say it's inconclusive. And they go against the FDA's conclusion that it is safe. And so it really continues in this controversy. And the issue is really for pregnant women and for children who are growing older. What do we do? And the reality is the problem with mercury amalgams is that apparently the other ways of filling up cavities do not last as long and are not as easy to do or don't seem to have the same applicability. You know, and that's, of course, part of the controversy, too, because some people say, well, dentists just don't want to use them.
Yeah. Well, this is not an easy thing because here we come with this advisory panel, but they're saying don't pull your fillings out of your teeth.
Right.
But it might not be good for you to have them in there.
Well, I would not. I definitely wouldn't pull my fillings out of my teeth. I've got mercury fillings. Once it's in there, in my mind, if I don't have a mercury level and there's really no evidence that you have these high mercury levels, I'm not concerned. It's really the thing about new fillings and children.
Well, what would you do then? Or what do they advise?
Well, there was a recent article looking at American children and Portuguese children. Some had mercury amalgams. Some had the other amalgams, which were not mercury. And they found absolutely no difference in neuropsychological tests and IQ tests or nerve tests among children who had mercury fillings or not. Well, the issue is, I think the issue is very similar to issues of pesticides and other things in the environment. There's some people who really want to make sure that they eat foods that have no pesticide, that are organic, and they're very, very careful. Those people should not have mercury fillings. There are other people who say, I'm going to use some reasonable care on what I'm going to eat and so on. Well, for those people, mercury fillings might be appropriate. The issue and the bottom line is there's no absolute one way or the other. You should go discuss that with your dentist, make an individual decision, and that's the best care.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. A listener with us now in Hayward, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
What's
up? My daughter has been treated with just about everything under the sun for acne for about 10 years. Her acne is primarily on her cheeks. She's currently taking a low-dose antibiotic and ortho-tricycline, and she's continuing to break out. And her dermatologist recently prescribed, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, spironolactone.
Mm-hmm. Spironolactone is a diuretic, and it's actually used for hirsutism, for hair. And does she have hair on her face at all?
Yes, I would say more than average.
More than average, and that's really what the spironolactone is for. That's what. But it's not for the acne. So how's her acne right now? What is she using?
I can't remember which antibiotic she's on right now.
But she's on an antibiotic.
An antibiotic and orthotricycline.
Okay. And she's putting topicals on her face, creams at all?
I'm not sure that she is right now. She might have a topical antibiotic. She's tried lots of different topicals.
Sure. So how can I help you?
Well, I'm wondering about any other suggestions you have, if the spironolactone will have any effect. I thought it also had a slight hormonal effect when used.
Well, it's used as an anti-sort of testosterone type hormone. We all produce small amounts of testosterone, and the spironolactone sort of blocks some of the aspects of these tiny amounts that are produced in women from the adrenal gland. It also works to sort of block other things. It's a minimal diuretic. Won't do anything for the acne. Seems to work for some women. For hirsutism, it's cheap, it's inexpensive, and it works well. So clearly she should have that. But is she pleased with her acne? Is she pleased with the doctor she's with?
She's pleased with her doctor, but she's had a number of different doctors, both at home, and then she's a university student now, so in the town she's in now, too.
So
just really are not. It seems like we're missing something.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may be missing something, or she may have some very significant acne. What I always recommend to people, if they're unsure whether they're missing something, is they get a second opinion from another dermatologist, in this case, not in the same town. So okay. That would be my recommendation, because there are drugs such as Accutane, which she may decide to take.
She's done that, too.
She's done that, and there are other drugs in that class. And some people have recalcitrant acne, but I would go to a university setting. What I would do is get a second opinion on this to try to handle this.
Well,
this can be such a frustrating problem.
What good would a second opinion do on acne? I mean, do you run through the things that you put on the acne?
No, it's kind of, in some ways it's similar to making a good stew, like the lamb stew that, that we made, that mm-hmm. Adam made, that is great. You taste something, you add a little bit of this, you add a little bit of that, then you watch and see what works. There are a number of drugs, and you try a different combination to see if that combination works. Clearly, moms are, of course, frustrated when their children, when their children have problems, and this acne problem should be looked at. And I think a second opinion now is really
important. Acne is really a real problem for young people. Yeah.
And it's a terrible problem for older people. The problem for people who are middle-aged, people in their 20s, people in their 30s and older who still have acne, they go, wait a minute, I thought I would stop this when I was a teenager, and in fact, a lot of young adults, especially in their 20s and 30s, still have it. And it's a problem. It's a social problem. People often withdraw if it's severe. They don't engage in social relationships. It can't. You have to look at it in its proper perspective as a major problem.
Talking about acne, Zorba, that leads us right into our myth buster for today. Can acne change with the weather?
Well, the answer is
it must be no, because we're busting a myth, and a lot of us think that acne can change.
The answer is yes.
Oh.
Acne really can.
So we're
really
reinforcing this medical myth.
The question is whether it's summer or whether it's winter, and it depends on which study you actually look at. I always was taught that it's the summer because when you're exposed to sun, your acne gets better. That's certainly what I have found to be the case. And of course, you don't want to expose yourself to too much sun because you might end up getting skin cancer.
Yeah.
But it depends. There was one article in the Journal of Dermatology in 2002 where nearly about 500 people had acne, and 56% said that they were worse in the summer, and 11% say they were worse in the winter. So in other words, these are people who said their acne got worse in the summer. And then there was another article in the same journal a couple years before that showed exactly the opposite, that about more than half the people said it was better in the summer than it is in the winter. So maybe it depends on where you are, where you live, and so on. I think on the whole, being out in the sun is better for your acne. So it's not a myth. It's a myth.
From that so-called research you just pointed out.
So-called research. This is science, Tom.
Well, it's totally contradictory.
Contradictory
research.
So
the answer must be no, acne doesn't change with the weather. It's just that some people think it changes with the weather.
There you go. No, I think acne does. I think on the whole, most studies show the summer is better for acne than the winter.
Less acne in the summer.
That is correct.
If you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, we'd love to hear from you. Just send an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. A listener now in Ketchum, Idaho. Hi.
Hi there.
What's up?
Zorba, I'm a runner, and I have been for 25 years, and I do a lot of marathons, and I'm a profuse sweater also. I have a common issue that's occurred probably the last 6-7 marathons, where I freeze up around 18-19 mile mark, where my legs just cramp so bad that I can't go on. It's definitely not a cardiovascular issue. My lungs are fine. I feel strong, but I have so much pain. I've been told over and over it's an electrolyte thing. I've tried calcium, potassium combinations, days before, the night before, during the race. Nothing works.
So nothing has worked in terms of taking, as you said, different electrolyte solutions.
I just figured that the sweating, I'm just getting it out of the body so quick, and that's where the cramps are coming from.
That would be a very logical thing, because we lose, in our sweat, we lose electrolytes. So have you talked to trainers? What have you talked to other marathoners? Obviously,
I've talked to everyone except you.
Everyone except me. I've talked to
physicians.
Everyone,
I've talked to certainly other runners. I've talked to a couple of nutritionists.
Mm-hmm. What sort of stretching do you do before you start?
I actually don't stretch a lot before I start. I tend to wait until the muscles are heated up. And I of course, end up stretching during the race because I can't walk.
but mm-hmm. I haven't stretched a lot before a race. Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of suggestions. You know, let's assume it's not electrolytes, which, you know, obviously you've taken electrolyte solutions and that's not the case. Let's assume that your muscle is cramping up at mile 18. Regular basis, whatever it is, you're using that muscle so much that it goes into spasm at mile 18. Have you thought about, I mean, I realize it's a marathon and, you know, you're in a marathon to try to get your best time. Have you thought about stopping at mile 16 or 17 before the cramp and spending 30 seconds, 1 minute, and doing stretching before the cramp occurs?
No.
That's what you should do.
That's an
I think that what's happening is this is a mechanical issue. Now, let's keep in mind, you're not going to win the marathon, so you're not going to get the prize at the end of the tunnel. You're doing it for your own personal good, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So we don't have to worry about the fact that I can't do it, man. I got to get there. I've got to get number one because you're not number one. Therefore, you're number one for you, but so we don't have to go through that.
Right.
What I would recommend is what you're having is you're having some sort of a foreshortening of that muscle that's producing the cramp. And what you want to do is you want to obviate that before the cramp. Now, it doesn't happen until mile 18, as you said. So I don't think doing it before you start the race is necessarily going to help. Might help, but probably not. But I think doing it at mile 16 may be the answer.
You can't do that. You're running in a race. You get down here and you're stretching, watching everybody zip by you.
That's exactly it. That's
waving,
exactly
hey,
it.
See you
that's
after the finish
that's
line.
Exact, that's right. Exactly.
You can't do that.
That's exactly
it. Even if you know you're not going to win, you're
right.
in get
right.
a race.
Right.
Hello.
I can't, but I'm going to try.
Right, you're going to try. But seriously, that's what I would do. I would think of it, I think it's a mechanical issue. I don't think it's an electrolyte issue. And the
With
question
uniform
is,
in both legs, it's
Yeah, but I think it's the way you're running. I think it's a mechanical issue.
You know,
so
actually,
I would try that.
I have been told that's a possibility.
Yeah, so I would, but I would
well,
time
don't they
it.
Have 10-mile
so,
races?
10-mile races, that's right. But I would do it I would do it 2 miles before. That's what I would do, and I would see what happens. Maybe that 30 seconds to 1 minute of stretching gets rid of the whole problem, and that's just the way your body is built, and, you know, you live with it. You're not going to win the marathon anyway,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, I'll give it a try.
Try it.
Okay,
and you know
I appreciate
what?
It.
And call us back and let us know.
Next one's in November. I'll call you in December.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot.
See you guys.
Yep. Zorba, we'll see you.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, our producer's available anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is the guy connecting all the right wires, a.k.a. our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1011Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.